It's 8:31, and we have with us live and kicking in the studios once again. Both of them, Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to say welcome to the listeners in Tacoma. I was born in Tacoma. So.
And Olympia. Yeah, it's exciting to be
here. I wasn't born in Olympia, but I was born in Tacoma.
But you only really do it one place at a time.
Yeah. You were rushed to Olympia right after that, I understand.
No.
But it is. We have a lot of Eat the State readers down in both areas, and it's exciting to be on the air down there.
It is.
All right. So let's dive into this week's subject matters. Seattle City Council has a big vote coming up this week.
Yeah, so the first thing we're going to do after welcoming Tacoma and Olympia is go into an item that has nothing to do with them. But
we will talk about Olympia later.
We will. We're going to talk about Olympia next. But first, an issue that we've talked about the last couple, 3 weeks from time to time on this show, the effort to ladle out some delicious corporate welfare to Nucor, the most profitable steel plant in the United States, located over in West Seattle, which has been asking for a discount on Seattle City light rates. Of course, steel plants are extremely energy intensive. It's the largest user of electricity in Seattle. And the concern about this is they were already given a discount 4 years ago, and it was money that they promised they would pay back the city. Well, this was under a previous owner, Birmingham Steel. Nucor bought them out after bankruptcy proceedings last year. But the plant itself is still very profitable and still very modern and in good shape. Well, the discount, despite the best efforts of Seattle City Councilman Nick Licata, passed through Gene Godden's subcommittee this past Wednesday. Usually it takes a couple, 3 weeks for those pieces of legislation to get on the docket on the full city council. But because this is being pushed so hard by Mayor Greg Nickels, remember that when he comes up for re-election next year, Mayor Greg Nickels, it's going to be on the docket for Monday. Monday afternoon, City Council. It's $4 million worth of corporate welfare. I actually talked to Licata a couple, three times this past week. I think three times. And he's pretty upset about this and specifically asked that on this program, we ask that listeners call in to City Council members. Of course, Nick doesn't particularly need to hear from you because we already know where he stands on this. But particularly,
well, you can always thank him.
You can always thank him. That's very true. But particularly the council members who might be undecided or who might be leaning in favor of this. The City Council General Office is 684-8888, and they can connect you through to any of the different offices or the different council members. It's first name dot last name at seattle.ci.wa.us, and email those folks or call them on Monday morning is even better, and urge them to vote no against spending city money on Nucor, because the problem is not just limited to Nucor. It's really also a matter of precedent. We saw this at the state level with Boeing. We're seeing it this legislative session with Boeing, where once you give a particularly enticing economic package to one large corporation on the premise of the generally fallacious premise of job creation or impact on the local economy, then everybody else wants it too. Every other business wants the same kind of favorative treatment. And that's the concern here with Nucor, that you have a city that has severe budgetary constraints, that we're passing specific legislation aimed at one company and one industry in order to give them breaks, and a lot of other companies are going to come wanting the same thing. So give City Council a call on Monday.
And what was that number again?
The number 684, area code 206-684-8888, and that'll connect you through to the front desk.
Very good. How about down on Olympia? Things have been happening down there as well.
Yes, we had the end of the 60-day short session of the legislature down in Olympia on Thursday night. And some bills were passed, some good bills and some bad bills, and some bills didn't make it. I just wanted to go over really quickly the ones that did pass. a charter school bill passed that critics say will siphon money away from public schools to pay for these new charter schools that are supposed to be run by nonprofit organizations. Now, the problem, I think, the main problem with the charter school bill is that it contains language that says if a public school doesn't meet the goals under No Child Left Behind as measured by the Wassel test, which is pretty controversial in itself, that the state superintendent can then just decide unilaterally that the school local school board has to change that school to a charter school. Now, what that is that's a mechanism whereby the state superintendent can just arbitrarily privatize portions of the school system. And I can really see where folks would be up in arms over that. I don't think that's a good idea either.
Particularly because one of the most controversial aspects of No Child Left Behind and the Wassel is that so many school districts are at risk of not passing.
Yeah.
So that's a mechanism that would actually expose especially urban school districts like Seattle's or Tacoma's, it's about a two- or three-step process, but the chances that that such districts could have a portion or all of their schools privatized is very real under this.
Right. Now, there are limits to the number of charter schools that can be set up, but that's only for, about the first 5 to 7 years of the plan. After
right.
that, who knows? I don't think there will be any limits on the schools that they can turn into charter schools. So it's a longer process than charter school supporters would like, but it is really a move towards privatizing the public school system. Now,
and remember once again that Mr. Paul Allen, among others, has pushed for this and has financial
supporter.
Interest in Edison, or has had a financial interest in Edison schools and private school companies.
Yeah. And in the state budget as well. There's some movement towards privatizing higher education, too. Now, for the first time, the state budget allows private colleges to compete with public universities for state funds, particularly in funding some high-demand programs like nursing programs and, slots in nursing programs and engineering programs as well. And this is unprecedented. This is also something that the state universities are really up in arms about. Now, the other big bill that passed down in Olympia this week was the primary system bill. Now, folks will remember we talked about this last week, that the courts overturned the Republican and the Democratic parties, and I also believe the Libertarian Party, too, sued to overturn our blanket primary system here in the state because they said that it did not give the political parties control over who would be nominated as their candidates for the final elections in November. Now, the state had to respond, and the legislature had to come up with a new primary system, and what has been most popular down in Olympia this year is the top two system, which is modeled after Louisiana's primary system. What that would do is it would allow the top two candidates from any party to advance to the final election. It would also allow voters to cross over. You could vote a Democrat for one race and a Republican for another race. So it really closely resembled what we used to have with our blanket primaries. And that's probably the main reason why it was so popular. However, the political parties, the Democrats and Republicans, have said that they would sue in the courts to have the top two primary overturned if it passed the legislature. And there was some concern that Gary Locke would veto the top two primary system if it were passed.
Actually, he came out yesterday.
And said
he would veto it. Yeah.
Now, what they did is the state legislature, in acknowledging this, said, well, okay, if Governor Locke is going to veto the top two system, which is our preference, we're going to pass a bill that says that's what we want. However, if he vetoes that language, the bill has other language saying in the event of a veto, then we will have an open primary system that allows people to go to the polls, choose whether they want a Democrat or a Republican or a Green Party or a Libertarian ballot or whatever, and then they could vote for the candidates that way, and they would not have to register with the various political parties in order to do that. Now, the problem is that the Democrats and the Republicans have said that if they don't get a primary system they like, they can just go to a primary caucus system, that they reserve the right to do that, which means it's highly likely that they will do that. I think it's highly likely that they will do that, which would force people to have to go and register as a Democrat and as a Republican in order to actually vote in the primaries.
Yeah, we talked about this at the time that it happened, that the Democratic caucus for the presidential primary was tremendously successful in terms of organizing for the Democratic Party, that 200,000 people turned out statewide. A lot of those were people that had never been on the rolls of the Democratic Party before. And so the Democratic Party, from an organizing standpoint, has all of these names and phone numbers and addresses and emails for future fundraising, for future party support that it never had before. And this is the sort of thing that's motivating the political parties, the two main political parties. It's not about allowing voters to have the broadest possible choice, or about enabling people to get elected that way. It's about the parties being able to build their own power base, and that's not necessarily what the public is interested in, but it's what Gary Locke seems to be interested in, and it's what a number of the legislators are too.
It's also not something that promotes democracy either.
Yeah.
Both of these plans, the top two plan and the open primary plan, would be really restrictive for third party candidates, smaller party candidates like Green Party candidates and Libertarian Party candidates, etc. Because in our former system, you could go and you could vote for a Democrat for one office, a Green Party candidate for another office, etc., a Socialist Party candidate for a third office, etc. But in the top two system, those parties would be completely and entirely shut out of the final election where most people participate. So most voters would never get a chance to vote for those candidates. In the open primary system, who's going to pick up a Green Party ballot that's got one candidate running for one office, when they can pick up a Democrat or a Republican Party ballot that has a candidate for every office? It's just not going to happen.
It also seems intriguing to me, if I heard you correctly, that they had included in the original legislation a clause there for if, you know, this gets vetoed, then this goes into effect.
Yeah.
Was that correct?
Yes, that's what I was talking about. If the top two system gets vetoed, then the open primary system
just from the standpoint of, you know, that we can write legislation that if, you know, the governor or the president vetoes something, then we do something else.
That wording is pretty controversial, and there are some people who are saying, too, that they don't think that that's legal, that if Locke vetoes the top two language, then they might actually sue in court because they don't think that it's legal for him to veto only a portion of a bill.
Yeah,
like
it'll almost certainly be challenged in court because, again, what they're trying to do is because they are under pressure from the Supreme Court ruling to have some sort of a system in place, and because the legislature is adjourning, if Locke vetoes it, of course the legislature doesn't want to have to come back, so that they wanted to write it in such a way that it would be taken care of and they wouldn't actually have to reconvene a special session.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, there were some good bills that passed in the legislature. I just want to talk about a couple of them. One was after the oil spill in the Puget Sound this winter at a refueling terminal, the state legislature has passed a law that requires the Department of Ecology to develop rules for deploying some kind of containment around ships that are refueling in state waters, something that is a no-brainer. And it's a good thing that it passed. Another good thing that passed were a couple of things inside the state budget. I talked a couple of weeks ago and last week about how there's a little extra money floating around Olympia this year versus last year. Some good things did get funded. The in-home healthcare workers had won a contract, and there was some question about whether or not the state budget would actually finance a pay raise and benefits for them. That did pass, and so they will get their 50-cent an hour raise, their workers' comp benefits, and their healthcare benefits, much, much needed for these folks. And then Medicaid premiums, there was a partial victory. Folks on low-income families on Medicaid, folks who are at 100% of the poverty level, which is $1,300 a month for a family of three, which hardly, by the way, gets you housing in most parts of Washington State for that amount. Folks who are between 100% of poverty level and 150% of poverty level will pay no premiums for their Medicaid coverage. That's a partial victory because folks who make more than 150% of the poverty level will have to pay some of their premiums in order to get Medicaid coverage. And there's some question about how many of those folks will actually drop off the plan and have no health insurance coverage for their children. So that's a wrap up.
All right. From Olympia. Talk about this week in Iraq.
What happened to our theme music for the Iraq?
We'll have to play it again soon.
Yeah, it got hit by a roadside bomb. That was
we're depending on you to do a rap version of that for us.
Oh,
now.
Okay.
Well, this week in Iraq, Major General Charles Swanick, the commander of the 82nd Airborne Division in Iraq, told an Associated Press reporter on Wednesday that he's extremely frustrated by delays in getting needed equipment to Iraqi police and paramilitary forces. That's the ICDC is the name of the paramilitary forces. His quote was, "If I think about when we got here in September, I kept expecting at that time that this equipment for police and the ICDC would arrive in November. November came around and I was told that it was going to arrive in January, and now I hear it's postponed until the end of March." Now, what he didn't say is that the part of the problem is that the $327 million contract to supply the Iraqi police and paramilitary forces was awarded under suspicious circumstances in January to a company called Noor USA. That company is run by a guy named Huda Faruqi, who is a close friend of Ahmed Chalabi.
Who is a close friend of?
Who is on the Pentagon's payroll.
Yeah.
Now, Noor USA had no experience in this field, and other companies complained. After the complaints, U.S. Army lawyers undertook a review of the bidding process for this contract and found various problems, including vague contract language, missing paperwork, and no documentation for how the bids from various companies were rated. The contracting officer in charge, who took over the investigation, said that he had never seen anything like it in the 29 years that he has spent in Army contracting.
And then that was for how much money again?
That was for $327 million to supply equipment, basic equipment like radios and bulletproof vests to the Iraqi police and paramilitary forces. But in the end, it may be a good thing that those guys don't get their equipment, because on Tuesday, two U.S. civilian workers and their Iraqi translator were killed in an ambush near Hilla. They were killed by Iraqi police. It was not a mistake. It was a targeted killing. At first, the coalition provisional authority officials said they were fake police, that they had to be insurgents dressed in Iraqi police uniforms. But after they ran them down and arrested these guys who had the bodies of their victims in the trunk of the car, that four of the six men involved had official Iraqi police ID and had gone through the program and trained to be Iraqi police. Now, one of the victims was a woman named Fern Holland. She's a lawyer who had helped draft the women's rights language in the new interim constitution, and she worked across the street from where several of these guys worked for in an Iraqi police headquarters. Now, it's worth noting that 90% of the men who staffed the Iraqi police were police under Saddam Hussein, and supposedly they went through a three-week course to teach them Western human rights values, but some folks would argue that that three-week course is not enough.
A lot of folks have also argued that the screening process by which the United States has in fact tried to weed out the people who have had problematic backgrounds from the police program, but they've done a very, very poor job of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to the issue of Iraqi contracts, the Pentagon this week asked the Justice Department to get involved in investigating Halliburton for overcharging the U.S. government for shipping to ship fuel into Iraq. Now, Halliburton has $18 billion worth of contracts in Iraq. The overcharges amounted to some $61 million through September 30th of last year, and then $20 million per month since then. So it's around $160 million in overcharges that Halliburton has made to the U.S. government for shipping fuel into Iraq. Now, the Justice Department, if they get involved in the case, can do a few things that the Pentagon can't. They can indict and press charges for criminal fraud, which the Pentagon can't do. They can assess hefty penalties and seek additional damages against Halliburton. And more importantly, they can pursue Halliburton under the False Claims Act, which would allow the government to collect up to three times the amount of the fraud or of the overcharges. So we'll see if the Justice Department decides to get involved. You know, with John Ashcroft in the hospital to get his gallbladder removed, I suppose anything is possible. In other fraud news, the Defense Department officials this week confirmed that Ahmed Chalabi is still on the Pentagon's payroll. He or his group, they pretty much amount to the same thing, receive about $340,000 per month of U.S. taxpayer money. The Pentagon calls this a, quote, long-standing partnership.
Yeah, this is the Iraqi National Congress is the group that you're talking about.
Yes, the Iraqi National Congress. Although this longstanding partnership has produced absolutely nothing of value except maybe some embarrassment over their fraudulent claims of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
And don't we have an extradition treaty with Jordan? I mean, shouldn't he have been sent back there for his previous financial dealings?
Oh yeah, he should, except that he's a Pentagon employee now, and so he has some protections. Now, one of the reasons, a Defense Department official told the New York Times that this alliance is proving much more useful now than it did before the war. And I think what he might have been referring to is that Chalabi has been instrumental in coercing the Shiites to accept and sign the interim constitution that was signed this week. Now, I've read the constitution. I'm not going to go into detail about what's in it. But I think the most interesting aspect of it is it elaborates on the timeline for democracy in Iraq. It sets up two additional phases. The first phase is the one of the interim government. That's what I call it. The interim government, which is going to rule in June 30th until the elections are held to elect an interim, the actual interim government, which will then be given as much time as they need. There's no time limit specified in the Constitution to draft a permanent Constitution, because right now we have the interim Constitution for the interim government and the interim government to use until they draft the permanent Constitution. Then once the permanent Constitution is voted on by the Iraqi people, then eventually sometime in the future, we're not sure when, there's no deadline, they will hold elections for a real Iraqi government.
Yeah, you can see why, particularly among the Shiites, is a fair amount of frustration about
whole process.
Yeah, about the whole process. About you know, we thought we were going to have an actual democracy where we're going to be able to vote on who our leaders are, and it's not working out that way. The net effect of a lot of this is that most of the clauses in the Constitution and most of the people who at the federal and local level and everything in between in Iraq are pretty much being vetted by Washington, and there's a lot of frustration with that in Iraq. We've gotten into the reasons why a number of times over past weeks.
That wraps it up for Iraq.
Well, one other thing I wanted to mention, this coming week is the first anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. I have a thing on workingforchange.com about that. And there's another very good column on workingforchange.com right now about wounded in Iraq and how that's been undercounted, and the number of wounded that are flooding Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C., which is where they're taken once they come back here from Germany, and how that's been undercounted. And even senators in Congress cannot get information from the Pentagon on not only how many soldiers have been wounded in Iraq, but even what the criteria for counting them as wounded are. The Pentagon says, well, we don't know. It's really quite scandalous. But there's a lot of what we could talk about in terms of the anniversary and what that means and what'll happen next year. But the thing to know right now is that next Saturday, a week from today, there are going to be demonstrations similar to the ones on February 15th last year, all over the globe, 50 different countries, every continent, at least 200 cities in the United States. There will be a massive one in New York City. There will be one here, probably in Olympia, for folks listening down there. And there will be one here in Seattle that'll start on Capitol Hill, I believe Broadway and Seneca at 11 o'clock in the morning. We'll be talking about that a lot more next week.
Very good. There's also another event happening this week on Tuesday.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, for the for information on the local event, the website is www.mar20th.org. And then on Tuesday, it'll also be the first anniversary of the killing of Rachel Corrie, the International Solidarity Movement volunteer from Olympia, who was in Palestine and was killed by an Iraqi Caterpillar tractor from the International
Israeli
Defense Forces. Israeli. Mm-hmm. I just said that wrong. Her death was the first of what have been several IDF attacks on international volunteers since then, and that anniversary will be marked by a march here in Seattle that will be on Tuesday evening, beginning at 5:30, meeting in front of the Asian Art Museum in Volunteer Park on Tuesday, and it'll go down to Seattle Central Community College from there.
All right, we only have a couple minutes left. Probably not enough time to do it justice, but we should at least mention, talk about the bombing that happened in Madrid this week.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of questioning at this point over who is responsible for the bombing of a couple different trains in Madrid that has left 200 dead. The Spanish government is trying to pin it on Basque separatists, even though a group with connections to Al-Qaeda, a Muslim fundamentalist group, has taken credit for it. And even though the Basque separatists, who have a history of terrorism, but they do not have a history of doing attacks on civilians of this scale, and the types of explosives that are being linked by the government to use by the Basques are explosives that were only used by Basque movements in the early days, a number of years ago, when they were doing attacks.
Yeah, because the government supposedly has better control over these explosives that are used a lot in the mining industry, which leads to the question of how did Muslim fundamentalist terrorists get a hold of explosives?
Within the country of Spain, yeah.
Right, get a hold of explosives that supposedly are heavily regulated by the Spanish government. That's a question that Aznar, the right-wing head of the Spanish government, would prefer that people ignore and not ask.
Yeah, so there's a real question of why, when you've got a fundamentalist group that has taken credit for it, when the type of blast points toward that, why the government is so insistent on trying to pin this on Basque separatists, why they're trying to find it useful to blame a movement that has a long political history within Spain for what really has been a heinous attack. It really raises some interesting, almost conspiratorial type questions of whether they're trying to blame the wrong group for political reasons.
Well, yeah, Aznar has a candidate that's running for prime minister against a socialist candidate. And the socialist candidate, it's a very close race. And Aznar and his candidate are running their campaign on getting rid of the whole Basque problem and just clamping down on Basque separatist groups. And so they're really trying to make political hay out of this, the same way George Bush used 9/11 to attack Iraq when Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with September 11th. Mm-hmm. So it's really pretty disgusting, I think.
Yeah, and again, it raises the question of where did the explosives come from and was somebody in the government involved?
Mm-hmm. Well, getting back to your point about the political end of it, isn't the election there tomorrow?
Yeah, the election is coming up pretty much right away. And there's also, folks should remember, too, that
talk about October surprises.
That Spain is one of our allies in Iraq, and there are Spanish troops there, and they've supported the invasion and everything from the get-go, and that was highly controversial in Spain. There was a huge amount of the population that was against supporting the war on terror.
Yeah. 2 million demonstrated in Madrid, another million in Barcelona.
Right, yeah. And so this would bring into question whether or not this could really topple Aznar's government if people really voted against him at the polls by saying, well, you supported the war on terror and it's only brought terrorism to Spain. It hasn't avoided, hasn't clamped down on it at all.
Okay, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And where exactly do people find Eat the State?
Beats me.
Okay. Eat the State can be found at bookstores, coffee shops, cafes around the Seattle area and the East Side area in Bellevue and some places north and south. And you can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you can give us a call at 206-903-9461.